It's time to spend some time with our new friend, Dr. John Kirk, our COVID catch-up for this week. Dr. Kirk, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Barry. I'm glad to be back and still COVID-free.
That's a good sign. You are a physician here in the community. Are you seeing patients, continuing to see patients now, or is it all telemedicine?
Thank you for asking. We are seeing patients both live and on the screen. They're still alive, of course. We are doing our best to keep it that way. We do have a little update on that. For our practice, we work with Adventist Health here at St. Helena, Adventist Health St. Helena Hospital. If patients are interested and a little concerned about coming in, certain criteria we are looking at as to which patients should and should not come in. In particular, if you're sick, don't come in. Call us. We'll talk you through it. We can even get on the phone and the TV screen with you, if you will, the computer screen or your phone, and talk to you, have a legitimate interaction. Obviously, there's some testing limitations that we can't do or exam things we can't do, but there's a lot of things, remarkably, we can do. And we'd like you to find out more about that at AdventistHealth.org/virtual visits, so that can help you. The challenges that we're having with patients are, I think, mostly patients are concerned, and I think we as providers are concerned. There's a lot of us who are getting infected with the COVID virus, and a lot of us are having worse outcomes at times. But realistically, that's what we do. We're here, and we're trying to keep that distance from affected or infected people by using these virtual visit options.
Good information. Let's jump into this week's topic, and this is very timely. Earlier this week, the governor came out with 6 steps that he outlined that are the path to getting back to normal in California. It was a watershed moment because it was time for the first time to actually talk about what has to happen next and looking down the road at this return to something like what we're used to. However, there are some major obstacles, some major challenges to achieve those 6 steps, and we're going to talk through some of that here this morning. Beginning with the question about testing. Talk about the testing that's needed and what that might look like and what you know about what kind of time frame we're talking about.
Excellent. Really, to be able to say, hey, we're okay to get back to normal, and of course I think our normal will be a new normal. Things will change. We'll find a lot of new processes that happen in our communities, our practices of business, and just day-to-day communications and entertainment. That being said, it will be incredibly important to know who has had the disease and thus has achieved some form of immunity. Remember, we still do not know how much immunity people will get, but something like chickenpox, for example, most people have immunity for the rest of their lives. We do not know if that will happen. Most of the experts do not think that it will be a lifetime immunity from the coronavirus COVID-2. However, it may be somewhat lasting, and that would be hopeful. Others are concerned that it will have the potential to migrate or mutate, I should say, and make it more like the common influenza experiences where we are trying to sort of play catch-up with our vaccines, but are guessing as to what the virus will come out with for that given year. And thus we tailor our vaccines, which have to be made far in advance to be able to protect our patients. The challenge is then to figure out who is affected. So testing, as you say, is one of the most important things. It's probably one of the most important things to limit spread in general. Initially, we have developed several tests now for the acute infection process to determine that you do, in fact, have coronavirus currently, given whatever symptoms you present with. Those tests are increasing in number, increasing in FDA approval, and decreasing in the speed with which we can get results, which, of course, is important if you have a patient who has symptoms and decisions need to be made with resources that are limited. If that person does not have COVID, perhaps that person then would be placed in a different room, for example, in the hospital, assuming they needed to be admitted. If they it took 4 days, like some of our previous testing had taken, they would not be able to make a reasonable decision, of course. The testing for immune response, or so-called autoantibodies, antibodies, that's the process that's the big ticket now. So there are three different tests that are, I think, FDA-approved at this point, and are being spread out to the providers in our community, to the hospitals in the community, et cetera. The goal there is to figure out, hey, have you had the test? Many of us have no symptoms. You've been talking about it. 20-25% of patients may have no symptoms during the course of the entire infection. They have it, they recover, and didn't know they had it. Some have mild infections, and most of us do. Probably 80% or 85% of us are seemingly having mild infections. Seems like the cold or maybe a mild flu. We get over it, and you know, sometimes we're certainly questioning now whether we have the coronavirus, but in general, that may or may not be true. There are many other options that are also coronaviruses that cause common cold, and the flu, of course, and then the rhinoviruses that cause the cold. But finding out who's had the disease will help us get back into society. So are we prepared? I would say initially, no. Right now, no. We do not have enough of the tests, but they are being made, they are being distributed, and that will determine largely our ability to get back into our normal life.
The physical part of this, we start talking about the testing. We've heard so far about drive-through testings. We've heard about self-tests. A friend of mine on Facebook posted a question of, if you really are talking about testing everyone, how do you go about that? There's 40 million people just in California. I brought up the idea, well, maybe like you sometimes have a mailing process, certain kinds of tests I've seen, they may give it to you at a doctor's office, but then you mail it in. So what are you anticipating in the actual physical process of testing people? What will it be like?
Well, I think all of the above is a good first answer on any multiple choice question, and that would be true from what you just said. We don't have enough options, for sure. I think one way is to sort of limit who we start doing that type of testing for. So one of the things would be contact testing. Someone who's had the exposure, there are ways to track the contacts, including using phone apps, for example, and then testing those patients or those potential patients who have been exposed to someone who has tested positive. In many cases, those patients will have autoimmune or immune antibodies to the COVID, and they would then be free, so to speak, to be back into the community in that sense after 14 days of quarantine. So limiting our tests to certain groups that have to be back in the public arena in a way that will help us get back to normal. So the court systems, the police and fire, of course, we're having our first responders out on the front lines currently, but being able to test them to give them individually peace of mind, but also the sense that there won't be any exposure risk to the people they're taking care of if they're either immune already or if they are not infected, perhaps they are not able to be in that same group of people that are allowed to go out into the public arena.
Yeah. Let's jump to a separate topic here in terms of therapies. We've heard a lot of things mentioned, very little that has been described as specifically effective, as far as what my reading says. What are you learning about therapeutics? I don't want to mention any of the – I'm going to let you take that without me saying anything more about what I've read. What's the story on therapeutics?
Well, I think it starts by saying that one of the few things that President Trump has gotten right is fake news. Unfortunately, it's often coming from President Trump. That being said, we have some serious concerns about the options that are available to us. Obviously, we get sick. We want something to help. We want it to treat us. We technically don't have anything that's FDA approved for treatment. We don't have significant study results to suggest that any individual drug and we certainly don't have the vaccines yet, although there are more than 70 vaccines currently being studied. There's three that are currently in trials, as of a couple days ago. Of course, those will take probably a good year to be able to clarify their effectiveness and then get out into the public. Same problem of testing. We have to get those tests or those vaccines, once approved and proven as safe, into the patients. But realistically, there's a lot of artificial, fake, or downright scams coming through the internet, through news services. I subscribe to probably 15 or 20 different medical news services, and I'm impressed with some of the lack of attention to detail in some of these services. Sometimes I feel like I'm being sold something, and that's certainly not something as a doctor we want. So first and foremost, we have to be very careful. Don't tell our friends and publicize on Facebook how, you know, XYZ drug is the cure-all. A case in point is a church, believe it or not, in I'm not even sure where that church is, but the bottom line is they've been selling to their constituents essentially bleach process, chlorine dioxide, that has great potential to kill, let alone injure the people who use it. And there's clearly no evidence that that's going to help patients. Certainly, we don't support drinking bleach or using bleach directly on your body, for example. And that's essentially what that product is for all practical purposes. All that being said, there are some studies right now on a drug called Remdesivir. It's R-E-M-D-E-S-I-V-I-R. It's a viral or an antiviral drug. It's showing some promise, but even then, the main study that was being done in China was just halted by the drug's manufacturer because there weren't enough people to enroll in it. Primarily because Chinese curve, if you will, they've gotten on the other side of the curve, and that flattening of the curve that we're talking about, they're on the far end and having very few new cases, so it's not an option for them to continue to test there. The hydroxychloroquine that we've heard, or chloroquine, that's the anti-malarian drug that's probably been talked about most in the literature. That's where we started with our fake news from our friend President Trump. Where he stated hydroxychloroquine, I don't know. It's looking like it's having some good results. That would be a phenomenal thing. That was March 19th by Trump in April 3rd. What do you have to lose? I'll say it again. What do you have to lose? Take it. I really think they should take it. Now, this is April 3rd. And then fourth, this is a powerful drug on malaria, and there are signs that it works on this, some very strong signs, et cetera, et cetera. The problem is it kills people, too. It injures them. It hurts their hearts. There were, I think, something like 7 or 8 deaths in a Brazilian study of 81 people using it, and they canceled the study accordingly and appropriately. That does not mean it doesn't have potential. There are signs in other studies that there may be some benefit. But we really feel in the medical community that we need to be prudent. We don't want to make it worse by giving you a treatment, so to speak, right?
Right. First, do no harm, right? Isn't that part of your oath?
That is the Hippocratic Oath, at least the part that we take of it. There's a lot more to it, of course.
And it's understandable that people are clutching at straws and wanting to come up with something, even, you know, with a placebo effect. I suppose if you take a mega dose of vitamin C, you're going to say, I've done it, you know, now I'm better and I feel better already or something, which is understandable. But the rigor of science demands that the studies be blind. Can you talk about how that process goes forward compared to what is known about, for example, the chloroquine now?
Sure. The standard highest quality study is a randomized double-blind controlled trial. So this means that we pick people by random. We try to eliminate biases from patients that might have be older or might have different levels of sickness, that may have issues related to other medications that they're using that would potentially bias the outcomes if they weren't the same in each group. Then we double blind it. We blind both the people who are receiving the medication as to whether they're getting the medicines or what we call a placebo. And I'll talk about placebo in one brief second. We blind them to what they're receiving, and then, of course, we blind patients, we blind the doctors, the providers who are giving the medicine. That's the optimal outcome. Of course, that's exceptionally difficult, if not almost impossible, to accomplish in this current situation. That being said, we are seeing an increase in randomized controlled trials that are blinded to the effect of the, or to the patient. Because the placebo effect is something that is monumental in everything medicine, probably other things in life as well. If you believe something will work, it probably will work. If we give you a medicine to treat your hot flashes, for example, as a woman with menopause who's unfortunately going through that change of life that leads to hot flashes, we tell you this is going to work. There's a good 30 to 35% of benefit that people will receive from that medication. So we have to do better than 30 to 35% with our medicines in order to say, hey, this is actually worthwhile.
We're talking with Dr. John Kirk. It's our COVID catch-up for this week, and we were focused on some of the steps that Governor Newsom laid out for getting back to normal. Let's jump again to the whole vaccine question. I guess the best starting point for me is, why does it take so long? You're talking about 12 to 18 months to have a vaccine. Why so long?
Well, part of the reason is simply the testing and the safety. Currently, there are probably six or seven different kinds of vaccines that are possible. Now, realistically, of those, let's say six different types, there's four of them that we've used in the past. That's great. There's been established safety in the concepts of using what we call, you know, live attenuated viruses. You know, those viruses that are inactivated have been used. These are things that we have used for 50 years or more. Viral-based or viral vector-based vaccines. I think that goes back to one of your comments earlier about the vectors in some good shows on TV. That has been used. Recombinant protein vaccines have been used. But there are two new kinds, RNA and DNA vaccines, which show great promise, and they are not possible to infect the people receiving them. So in theory, they should be safe. But there are other ramifications potentially that have been seen. And so studying just the safety of them in small groups prior to even making them in any large quantities and certainly distributing them to populations is an issue. So that process simply takes time. Historically, it may have taken years, 5-10 years to get a vaccine to market. But given the importance of not only the current situation, but vaccines in general, there are some fast track options. And so that's what we're kind of in the face of right now, is going through the fast tracks, but still the timing of testing for safety initially, and then actually ramping up the production to get it to a sufficient level is something that takes a good deal of time. Some of the vaccines can be done much quicker than the others. And in particular, those are the two new types, the RNA and DNA types, but we've never used them before. So that brings up the safety issue. And then, as you brought up earlier, you know, with testing, how do we actually get this in the hands of, or into the arms and or buttocks of all of our patients? That process has to be unloaded and taken, not to mention the distribution of the medicine as well.
Well, it feels like a long road, doesn't it?
It's a challenge. You know, some good news, I think. I think there's a lot of focus, an immense amount of focus on it. It's hard sometimes to separate the wheat from the chaff, but it's our work. That's what we're doing.
Yeah. One last question on the herd immunity topic. The case is being made by some people, in fact, has been from the beginning. Trump himself at one point said, what if we just let it wash over us? At that time, at the beginning of this, the idea of just letting it run wild led to the idea there would be an immense amount of death and suffering. At this point, is it any different? Do we feel that enough people have been exposed and did not get ill that you could take the restrictions off and just see what happens?
Yeah, so no. There's not been enough exposure. The concept of herd immunity, and basically just for the people listening out there and ourselves, and herd immunity is basically when you have a high enough percentage, and it's been popularized or published as somewhere between 80-85% of us having had exposure and recovered, or a vaccine, which, as we just discussed, does not currently exist. So 80-85% of us probably need to have that in order to actually achieve a, quote, herd immunity. And what that basically says is it limits the disease spread from person to person because there's just not enough unaffected people to carry it to the next person. We had talked in the past about the R factor, how easy it is to get infected by any given disease. That goal is to decrease that R factor, that one person gives the disease to less than one person because they're just not getting exposure. That's what our shelter in place is doing, and doing quite well, particularly here in California, it seems, compared to many of the other states and countries. So that's our goal. It would not make sense to count on herd immunity because, as you alluded to, the level of deaths worldwide and in our country, just in this state alone, would top multiple millions, and it's certainly something that we can't afford to do.
You've been listening to our COVID catch-up for this week with Dr. John Kirk, who is a physician here in the local community in the Adventist healthcare system. Dr. Kirk, excellent content as always. A pleasure, and I get to talk to you again next week, right?
You got it. Thank you, Barry. It's a great pleasure to talk with you.
Very good, sir. Take care.